who are not normally with us, we're in the 8th chapter of the book of Judges. I can tell you're impressed by that.
Yeah.
Okay. 292. How close is that? I want to see how close that is in yours. He's not going to answer me how close it is. Wow. I get more on a page than you do.
On the commentary.
Oh. As we, you don't stop at 292 then, man. Okay. last week we looked at, and Elaine cannot believe she misses 1 week, and we did a whole chapter. That's never happened in the history of the church. We've never done a whole chapter. So, but last week we did look at the 7th chapter, and that was the occasion where God called Gideon to lead the men against the Midianite armies. And you'll remember that God at first told him they had over 30,000 men, about 32,000, something like that, is what we thought. And God pretty much says, that's too many guys, because you'll think you did it. So the Lord says, tell Gideon, tell anybody who is afraid, go on home. So he did, and I believe they got down to 10,000 men. And then God says, even the 10,000 is too much. So you take them down to the brook, have them take a drink out of the brook, you watch them. And the men who do this, you keep. The men who do not do this, you send them on their way. Gets down to 300 men to go against thousands of Midianites. And remember, as we started this story of Gideon, as we're going through the Judges, it was God who said of Gideon, Gideon, you are a mighty man. Gideon was, and at that time when God said that, Gideon was hiding from the Midianites in his dad's threshing floor. And we may even have some reason why that in this chapter, why he would be hiding. Maybe something that infers. I don't know if we'll get that far. Never promise anything, but
you'll never know.
So they had won the battle, but just winning the battle was not enough for Gideon. He wanted to chase down the Midianites and destroy them. He wanted to make sure that the kings, those who were leading the Midianite armies, would be destroyed. So that's what he's doing. At the end of chapter 7, he has called together the different tribes. Verse 23 of chapter 7 says he called together the men of Naphtali, of Asher, all of Manasseh, to pursue the Midianites. But there's another prominent tribe that he did not call. And he's going to have some issues with that tribe, starting with chapter 8. You ever notice that no matter what you do, someone's going to have an issue with what you do? Is that not life? And so we have here someone who has an issue, or someone's who have an issue with Gideon. So here's what it says in verse 1. It says, now the men of Ephraim said to him, why have you done this to us by not calling us when you went to fight with the Midianites? And they reprimanded him sharply. Well, Gideon made a call out, we know, when the initial battle was going to come. And then again, God pared down the number. And I don't know if they're referring to the initial battle here or more the second call when he called the other tribes to chase them down. It seems more likely that second thing is true, which again would tell you something about some attitude. Once the victory's won, hey, let's join in. Because you know what happens after victory's won, then you start getting all the booty and all the stuff that's left behind and stuff, and they, I'm sure they wanted to have their share of all of that stuff. So they were very angry with Gideon. Gideon has an interesting response. When I read this today, I thought, man, Gideon, he could run for office. Because he is really a politician here. He's not really, you don't see him as a real stern judge. Just tell him, you know, my first approach, I'm going to say Doug's first approach, definitely Rick's first approach would have been, y'all need to take something, get over it, you know, type of thing. You get out of my face type thing, right? That's what you'd have told him. I know you would. I played golf with you. I know you would have. Okay? But that's not Gideon. Gideon was the diplomat. Look at what he says here in verse 2 and 3. He says, so he said to them, what have I done now in comparison to you? Well, you know what? That is quite a question. Okay? It says, is it not Is it not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abazir? God has delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb, and Zeb. And what was I able to do in comparison with you? Then their anger toward him abated when he said that. Now, so what has happened? What has happened is that Gideon has led the 300 in the battle into victory. And then you have these armies fleeing, these people fleeing. Apparently in the fleeing, the men of Ephraim had captured these two leaders. Okay? Because they're fleeing from Gideon. And the tribe of Ephraim captures these two men. And what does Gideon say? Well, what did we do in comparison? Look what you did. You got a couple of princes. We don't have anybody. And these guys say, oh, you're right. We're wonderful. Thank you, Gideon. People are fickle.
Yeah, but he's also referring to the status of the tribes.
Yeah.
Ephraim was one of the top, if not the top tribe at that time, mm-hmm. in all of Israel. And who does he come from, Gideon?
Well, he comes from...
Yeah, well, this little area, Abizir.
Right.
Which is nobody.
Right.
So, in essence, what he said here is true.
Well, that's... Yeah. Yes and no.
I understand.
You don't see any of these guys standing up. You don't see any of these guys being called mighty men by God. Matter of fact, you see these being very self-centered people who want to take part in a victory they have no part in.
Yeah, but there's a change that's happened. See, you and I are not going to agree on this.
Okay. There's a first.
And I'll tell you why, because I know that Gideon is one of your favorite judges. Yes?
Well, yeah, but he's got problems.
Well, now that's... Okay. See, I don't see God leading him from the point after the 300. Okay? I don't see any communication with God anymore. What I see is now Gideon becoming a man in power.
There is little doubt as we move through chapter 8 that Gideon moves away from the Lord, that he gets a big head. Okay? There, he takes some of the a lot of the well, we'll read about that. He takes.
We're right away then.
Well, sort of. Gideon's not perfect, but he's still one of my favorite judges.
Okay.
Trying to name one of the judges that are perfect.
I'll take Deborah any day.
Okay, you can. Okay, how many for Samuel? Anybody in here for Samson? You want Samson, don't you?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Anyway, so this may be the beginning of Gideon's, what Doug is referring to, and it seems to be that way if this is in any way chronological, because he's right. He does not hear from God, apparently. It's not recorded for us, nor is there any indication that he actually seeks God from this point forward. And he's like the rest of us. Sometimes I always go back to your illustration on Sunday. That's just such a vivid illustration of a man of God. And the guy, he's not even named in the scripture. He's just called the man of God. And the man of God who clearly hears from God. I mean, so clear that he says, God says do this. God said don't even come back this way. Don't eat. Don't drink there. Don't come back this way. It's so clear. So close to God. Experiencing God's presence in his life. And how quickly, when God's not speaking or when you're not hearing God, you listen to other voices and you head down, quickly go down the wrong road. And it happens for Gideon here. Now, there are some good consequences before we finish Gideon off. Okay? There are some good consequences. There is peace in the land. Okay? But remember the pattern that we've established here in the book of Judges. God raises up a judge because the people call and say, help. Not once have we yet seen the people say, God, we repent, right? In all this book, not once they say, God, we've sinned against you. We want to love you. We want to know you. Every time their call is the same, help us. And God in his mercy and his grace helps them. And even through imperfect judges, as we've discovered, he helps them. And he does give them, even with Gideon, a 40 years of peace. And then once Gideon's gone, there's some consequences of that too that we'll read. So, but you do see that Gideon is starting to, I think, manipulate That's why I call him a politician. I think politicians are manipulators. Yeah. Statesmen are okay, but politicians are another matter. So, verse 4 says, when Gideon came to the Jordan, he and the 300 men who were with him crossed over, exhausted, but in pursuit. So, they are chasing after the Midianites. They want to destroy them. We know that. Okay. And he's driving these guys. He's driving these guys very hard. They're hungry. They're thirsty. They're tired. Can you imagine 300 men that have been used to destroy armies of 1,000? Now, again, we know the story that we read that basically God confused them and they turned on each other and killed each other. But from that point on, when these men started to scatter, then you have Gideon leading these 300 to chase these men down. And again, I mean, it doesn't give us all the detail, but you know when they found a group of them, or they found, you know, some here, they would fight them, they would kill them and move on. That was the task. That's what they were about and stuff. So they're exhausted. Gideon continues to drive them in pursuit of these kings. We could ask the question, is this what God wanted to do even? Did God tell him? I don't know that we have any instruction of God in telling him to pursue these kings. I don't know that you can almost make a case for God's part of this is over. God gave them victory over the thousands. God did it. And now Gideon seems to be taking up the sword and sort of getting... He's kind of believing his own press releases. You know, and so he's driving these men. Leadership becomes a factor at this point that I want us to consider just for a moment. I'm reading a book, and I've been reading it for a couple months now, just taking my time. It's a book called Lead Like Jesus. It's a great book. And it teaches servant leadership, of course. It teaches a caring leadership. It teaches a leadership that does not just drive people till they're completely exhausted and cannot even function, but a leadership that encourages people while feeding their soul and while making sure they know that they don't just exist to follow the leader. You see, that's a lot of leaders believe that our church, and I've had pastors talk, my church exists to support my ministry. No, it doesn't. But there are a lot of pastors that lead from that position. Okay, so one of the things that I see here with Gideon too is Gideon has moved, in my mind, from this man hearing the Lord and leading these men as God told him to lead the men under God's leadership, to driving these people, his men, to fulfill what Gideon desires now. And that's always a dangerous thing. And when you talk about burnout, I really think that's where burnout comes, you know, even in the church. We're just driving people to get a program accomplished or an agenda accomplished instead of continually seeking the Lord and trusting Him to lead us. And then, again, remembering that the ministry is not the program. You know, in the book, and I've been reminded this over, the ministry is the people. It's not the program, it's the people of God. And if we forget that, then all we are is program pushers. All we are is using the people to accomplish what we think needs to be accomplished. And it sounds good when something's accomplished, a goal is achieved, except what do you got then? Emptiness. Meaninglessness, you know. I mean, put a little pin on your shirt saying, I achieved this, but what, you know, what do you have? Type of thing. So I see that in Gideon here now, that I find no indication that God has told him to do what he's doing now, but I think he has a need. Something in him is driving him to this place, and because it's driving him to this place, he's driving his troops to this place of sheer exhaustion. Now, we're about to see where exhaustion can lead. And it leads to the place of cruelty. The first step of cruelty, the cruelty to his own men by doing what he's doing here. But there's going to be some other cruelty that it's hard to judge because we don't live in this time. But some of the things that he will do or lead his people do seems quite extreme. And you don't have God telling him to do these things. All right, so Anything else before we move on? I just want to share a little bit about the leadership factor there.
God knew when he had his 300 men, he knew what the outcome was going to be, and he also knew where Gideon was going afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So you wonder, why did he allow the victory in that way when he knew Gideon? You know, everybody, when they get up here, they forget where they were.
Well, I think we're part of the answer to that question, Frank. We know we're sitting here 1,000 years this side of it, and we know where the glory goes. We know where the glory goes. And throughout the history of Israel, they've heard the same story that we've read. And God glorifying himself through what he did here. Even though you have a man like many of us who have experienced God working in our life, where we've trusted him, where we've seen his supernatural work and stuff, and we just say, praise you, Lord, for doing that. And then it's just like a couple of days later, we've forgotten that God did that, and we're heading off on our own again.
That's right.
So we're not so different.
No.
Especially if pride comes into it a little bit.
Well, pride is before fall every time.
Exactly.
And
you forget about the big picture.
Yeah. When he seen what happened to the army, I mean, what inflated his mind. So
yeah.
He couldn't think clearly.
You would almost hope what that would do would humble somebody instead of build pride up. Because he said, I didn't have anything to do with this. Maxine.
If you're going to talk about some of the mistakes that Gideon starts to make, well, I can't remember who the poet is, but he said, weariness makes cowards of us all.
Yeah, and you know what? That fear or that cowardice does not always display itself in running from things. It could lead us to run to things and do things we wouldn't normally do. Okay, anybody else? Everybody say welcome back to Donna.
Yeah.
Was you part of Gideon's army? No. Okay.
Not that old.
Okay. All right. Verse 5 then, if no one has anything else you want to say on that. Every one of you are leaders. I just want to say this before I move. Don't miss that leadership issue, because every one of you are leaders in some aspect, whether it's in the home, whether it's with your kids, your grandkids, in a classroom somewhere, in a business somewhere. You know, God has given you that place, and I think, you know, we all need to be sure that we are leading like Jesus leads. You know, it's really important. I think there are some universal truths there. I'll share some of that with you as I finish the study and stuff, but just keep that in mind if you would at this time. Verse 5 then. So then he said to them, to the men of Sukkoth. So what is happening here? Okay. Sukkoth is in the region of Gad. Okay. Gad is, well, it's on this shore of the Sea of Galilee. You were in Gad. You probably, in the New Testament, there was a man that was from a place called Gad. You were there. And he's called the Gadarene. And remember that guy?
Yes.
He was possessed by demons. And the demons begged Jesus not to just cast them to the pit. And there was a herd of pigs there. Okay, so you're looking at this region. Now, remember, the initial battle is in the Jezreel Valley, which runs, you know, the mountain regions there. You have Mount Carmel, you have Mount Megiddo, okay, Mount Tabor, all of those right here in the Jezreel Valley. Today in the Jezreel Valley, there's airstrips and stuff right there. So, so they're heading east. Here's Mount Tabor. They're heading east. And here's Gadara. You see it right here. This is the area they're in right here. Okay? So, in there's a place called Sukkoth. And as they're pursuing the Midianite armies that go through Sukkoth, and Gideon says to the men there, please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted. And I'm pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna, kings That's pretty good. It's all Amunah. Kings of Midian. So he comes to him, and again, he's desiring things. He's desiring someone else to take care of his troops. Now, in one way, this is not unusual. In another way, it is unusual. And here's the way it is. I'm sure the people at Sukkoth have heard what has happened. Okay? Yet at the same time, Gideon only has a handful of men with him. At the most at this time, he has 300. Okay? Some would say maybe some of the other tribes that he called have joined him in this pursuit. But with him, you'll see their response. It says, verse 6, and the leaders of Sukkoth said, "Are the hands of Zeba and Zunamah now in your hand that we should give bread to your army?" Now, do you see that there's somewhat some fear there? The Midianites had a reputation, and they were powerful. And basically, they're asking a pretty sensible question, at least from a personal safety standpoint. That is, do you really have control of these kings? Do they are they you have them in captivity? Are you sure that if we feed your troops that they're not going to come back against us? That becomes an issue, doesn't it? You support the enemy. Guess what's going to happen to the armies that you're supporting against them? Okay. Again, the Midianites have a long-standing reputation as a powerful people. Even prior to this, again, remember he said Gideon was afraid of them. He was hiding in his father's threshing floor. So it's not a small thing to just say, you know what, I'll do this. It really would take a belief that whatever army you're supporting in opposition to the majority army really is an army that's going to have victory. Because you don't want the other army to come back and destroy you. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. So, they want to know that. And verse 7 says, "So Gideon said, 'For this cause, when the Lord had delivered Zeba and Zunamah into my hand, then I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars.'" Okay. First of all, he didn't answer the question. He didn't. They want to make sure they were safe if they helped them. Gideon seems to be filled with anger. Seems to be, huh? What's he do? He's moved from politician at the beginning of our little study here to tyrant at this place. And he says, "Because you did not help me, because you did not heed what I've told you, that after I kill these men, after I take them into captivity, then I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars." So basically, he says he's going to beat them and torture them because they did not help him. Interesting, though, there's no indication that he said he's going to kill them. He was just going to make their life miserable. For their rejection. Something that may be interesting to you, may not. Up in this area, I don't know if some of you who were in Israel would just remember. Up in here, they had right up above here is where we went to Dan and stuff like that. But between Dan and the Sea of Galilee, the vegetation, Dan is like a forest up there. Get down toward the Sea of Galilee and the vegetation like it is here in the desert, a small plant. And it's there that you find a lot of those plants that they believe was used to make the crown of thorns for Jesus. A lot of those plants, they stand about this high and they had the big old thorns on them and stuff. So some would say maybe he was referencing that because that was the type of region that was. If you remember that, it's not a whole lot of trees around there. A lot of shrubbery type thing, but not a whole lot of trees around there in that area. And so he could be referencing that. All right, it says, then verse 8, "Then he went up from there to Penuel." So he is moving on. And I did not find Penuel on here. Did anybody find that in any of their studies?
It's just a hair south of Sukkoth.
Okay. And I don't have Sukkoth on this one.
I have it on mine.
My Bible's falling apart.
Oh, I just want to see about where that is. A portable mat.
Uh-huh. You see it there?
Where?
It's farther south than you think. The region of Gad is Galilee and Dead Sea.
They have it way down low, don't they?
Yes, they do.
Wow. They have hers way down low.
Issachar.
Yeah, yours is way down low also.
Yeah.
Wow.
South.
That would be lower than I would have thought.
Now, Pastor, was the Midianites in Succoth?
Have you found it?
And when he was there?
Well, it seemed that they were near there. I don't know if they were actually in there, but they were in all this region. And remember, they were ruling, or they were raiding. I don't even want to know if I want to say ruling, because remember the Midianites were a
nomadic.
Thank you. I need the help with the words here. The nomadic. They were nomadic people, and they were raiders. That's what they did. They raided. They were like guerrilla warfare. They would raid in, do something, and come back out. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I don't know if someone did this last week or said it. My notes on chapter 7 identifies them as camel riding marauders.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, they're fleeing. They're certainly. The men in Succoth are going to know that these guys went through. There's a pretty big number that's on them.
Right. And remember this valley, Jezreel Valley, it runs pretty well northwest to southeast. So that would not be too far off if it came right down like that.
Yeah.
And Gadara, remember, or Gad, excuse me. Gadara is a community. Gad is a region. Okay, two different things. You were going to say something?
No.
Okay. I thought you had a business call.
I already busted off.
Oh, okay. What a good guy.
Don't get me started.
Okay. All right. So, verse 8, then he went up from there to Penuel and spoke to them in the same way. Okay. And the men of Penuel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered him. So again, the concern is real. And Doug says, clearly the Midianite army has gone this way. But I would say that these two communities saw enough people, enough men, even though they may have been on the run, that the fear would still be there. And then, again, the reputation of them being nomadic and marauding groups like that. So, but they answered the same way. So, verse 9 said, So he also spoke to the men of Penuel, saying, when I come back in peace, I will tear down this tower. Now we have a reference to something that we don't have any other reference for. Okay, what was the tower?
A watchtower?
It would certainly be either a monument or a watchtower, something prominent within that community that was an identifier that clearly I think they would have been proud of, and certainly would have been used for watching and for make sure that you see that when the enemies are coming and stuff like that. The other aspect here is some of the commentators carry this on beyond just the tower, but that the tower represents the wall, all of the wall. Because in that day, a wall around the city was an indication that it was a city, that it was safe, that it was fortified. And when he said, I'm going to tear down this tower, they understood that meant that he was going to remove their wall of safety. He was going to take that away from them. Okay. So now he's got two other people that he's mad at, right? People of Succoth, people of Penuel. Okay, now verse 10. So now Ziba and Zunamma were at Karkor. Thank you. Karkor. Now, again, where do you have that on your map? Karkor.
No. They won't find Clark.
Okay.
It's about 100 miles east of the Dead Sea, they think.
East? Well, that's a long way from where they are, even with those two.
That's what they think.
So we don't have a time span. We don't have a time span break between his threat to these two communities, which were relatively close to each other, and the finding of these two kings. So basically what's he do? He chases them down. But look at what it says there. And their armies with them, about 15,000 men. So they that's a significant army. Especially in that day and time. Wouldn't you agree? What does he have with him? His 300. So it says, all who left, all who were left of all the army of the people of the east for 120,000 men who drew the sword had fallen. So you have, they started with 135,000 men. And remember, Gideon's initial army was 32,000. And God said, that's too many. Can you imagine going up against 135,000 men with 300 guys? Wow. But look at how many have fallen. How many have died. Since the initiation of that battle, and clearly the majority of them died when God confused them. They took up arms against each other and they killed each other. And then, of course, some have died since Gideon and his group have chased them down. So it's at verse 11. Then Gideon went up by the road of those who dwell in the tents on the east, Nobah and Jogbeha, whatever that is. And he attacked the army while the camp felt secure. Guerrilla warfare. When the camp thought everything was okay, I would guess they would probably have felt, especially if it's as far as what you seem to indicate, that the commentators say, they had to think, we're all right. There's no way that Gideon or anybody's going to chase us out here in the middle of this desert. And again, everybody remember what the Dead Sea was like and all the region around the Dead Sea. The guys when we travel over there, they always say, "Well, you're used to this. It looks like Arizona because we, you know, Arizona's there." I said, "No, our desert is pretty. It doesn't look like this. And if you want to talk about desolate, that's desolate. There's nothing there. Oh, maybe a little scrawny tree every 2 or 3 miles. That's it. And other than that, you know, it's just rock, sand, dirt. The Dead Sea is an amazing place." Because it is, it's exactly what it's dead. There's nothing alive in the Dead Sea. There's no bushes underneath. There's no sea creatures. There's no fish. There's nothing. It is completely dead. But it's good for your skin. If you don't stay there too long.
It is.
Stay there too long, then you'll be part of the Dead Sea. Maxine,
like,
yes.
It sounds like an oxymoron, but I've heard realtors here describe this area as a fertile desert.
Yeah. I think our desert's beautiful. Of course, I'm biased. I've lived here all my life. But I do. I think we have a beautiful desert. And it clearly is fertile. If you grew up here, you knew around Chandler, the Casa Grande area, and all those, you know, a lot of stuff was grown out there before they sold it off to the semiconductor people and all that stuff. But
that's another story.
Again, where they would have been, if they were anywhere in this region, then you add 100 miles east there's nothing there. It's desert. Matter of fact, you're moving down into the, today, if you just want to know where this is, you're moving down in the lower region of Jordan, or the northern region of today, what's known as Saudi Arabia. That's the kind of area that you're talking about right there. Okay. Any questions or comments? All right, so then when verse 12, when Ziba and Zula, I can't even say it now. Thank you, whatever. Fled, he pursued them, and he took the two kings of Midian, Ziba and Zalmunna, and routed the whole army. Again, they're just, it's an amazing thing. You have to wonder right now, is this, again, is this so much the hand of God right now, or is it just you have an army that's just completely demoralized and filled with fear? When you look up and you see Gideon, remember how this all began? It began by God giving dreams to the Midianite armies and scaring them about Gideon, who they'd never heard of before. And then when the men attacked, when the 300 attacked, that's what he said, the sword of the Lord and Gideon. Remember, that's what they screamed when they come in there. And now they're looking around, and I don't think, again, they felt they were secure. They felt they were away from Gideon. They look up and they see Gideon and his army of 300 coming again. Again, from a perspective of human being, 300 against 15,000, we'll take them easily. Except if your heart's been torn out of you. if you have no will to fight anymore.
Well, you're two kings now. Mm-hmm. Two kings. They run at the first sign of trouble. And if you're a soldier and you see your kings running, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
You're going to run too. So I would think that this camp scattered in every direction out of panic.
Completely demoralized. All right, it said, verse 13. And again, we don't know all the time span of all this. And so it's just a story that's given to us, and we're given the whole picture. It's not so much every intimate detail. So verse 13, and Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from battle, from the ascent of Harris, and he caught a young man of the men of Succoth. So he's heading back from over here somewhere, heading back, and he sees a young man. And he recognized that this... Remember, you're talking about tribal people, so they clearly some identification, so he knew that this young man was from this tribe or this group of people. And so he sees this young man, and he began... And it said, my translation says he interrogated him. Anybody else?
Yeah. Questioning.
Mike doesn't even question him. Just that he demanded that he write down the names of the...
So you have a demand, you have an interrogation, you have a questioning. Okay? So he makes this young man write down names, and here's what it says, and he wrote down for him the leaders of Succoth and its elders, 77 men in all. So Gideon wants the leadership of the town that refused to feed his men. He wanted them to be held responsible. Now, what he's going to do to these guys? He will not kill them. We'll read about that. But what he does is he completely humiliates them. These are the elders. These are the leaders. And again, from my perspective, I know I don't live in this generation. This is really a cruel, cruel thing that he does to these people. All right. So, verse 15. Then he came to the men of Succoth and said, "Here are Zeba and Zumana, about whom you ridiculed me, saying, 'Are the hands of Zeba and Zumana now in your hand, that we should give bread to your weary men?'" So he drug these kings back with them, stands them up in front of these elders and stuff, and said, "See, here they are. You know, it's like you challenge me, you refuse to help me. You know, this is really confrontational, to say the least." The other thing it is, it's intimidating. Because, again, remember, these people in Succoth know who the Midianites are. They know who these kings are. They know the number of men that continue to pass through their area as they went into the different areas to fight and stuff, the raiders and stuff. And now they see these two kings humbled before Gideon, and Gideon wants them to know, I'm Gideon. All right? So he brings these two kings before them. And then verse 16, look at what he does. It says, he took the elders of the city and thorns and of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth. Now that's a nice way to put it.
Yeah.
You know, he taught them. You know, Sunday morning we're going to have a new Sunday school format. I'm going to go out here, get some cactus stuff, and I'm going to teach you. You know, it's like my dad used to teach me. Not with thorns, but with he had different instruments when he taught me different things, you know. Mine was usually the belt. And it was a daily course. I don't know why I was a good kid.
That's
embossing.
Huh? That's embossing.
Yeah, that's true. But isn't it interesting the way... Now, mine says taught. Does someone have a different one in a different translation?
Discipline?
Taught him a lesson. Does yours actually say taught him a lesson?
Yeah, that's what mine says.
Wow. Well, and you know what? That is the inference of what he's saying here.
Yeah, right.
That he... You don't do that to me. Type of thing. Now, the commentator I read today does not agree with Doug at all. Because he leaves, and it was interesting when I was reading this today, preparing for tonight, and I was thinking, I'm more where you are with this, because I said, I can't, it doesn't make sense. This doesn't seem godly to me. But there are a lot of things I got to confess. There are a lot of things in the Old Testament I think, you know, where's God in this? You know, and some of the things were quite brutal, and God was clearly in it. So I couldn't just say because it was brutal, God wasn't in it. But as Doug says, you don't see God in any portion of this. In all of chapter 8, have you seen God's name mentioned? Have you heard God say anything? Have you seen any leadership of God? Any of these things? So the commentator left, it continues all the way through chapter 8. They leave Gideon as a great champion. They leave Gideon as a great hero. And sometimes I think that's unfortunate because I think, as we talked about some of the message that God wants to get across, the wonderful thing to me about the scripture is how honest it is. You know, what's the Bible say about David? David is a man after God's own heart. It didn't have to tell us anything else about David, but it tells us everything about David. Here's a man after God's own heart who is guilty of murder, adultery. And we can start listing all these things and stuff. The Bible is honest about these things. And I think God does that or allows us to see it. God doesn't make them that way. That's the way they are. But I think God allows us to see it so we're careful not to make idols out of these Bible heroes, what we call Bible heroes. I think we ought to be careful of that too. These were real men living in real times, dealing with real issues, having the same struggles we have today of faith, of trust, and certainly many of them God worked in a supernatural way, but we cannot forget that it is God working through these men and ladies, God working through them, that's making all the difference in the world, and we got to be very careful we don't exalt them. That doesn't mean we can't admire some of their aspects. We do. Just like we admire each other's aspects and things that God does. But again, got to be very careful we don't exalt them to a place that the Bible never intended them to be to. I always think of Elijah. Elijah's the greatest Old Testament prophet. Okay, as far as even Jesus references was that the only one that was actually greater than Elijah was John the Baptist according to Jesus. But look at Elijah. He wins that great battle with the prophets of Baal, and he slaughters the prophets of Baal, and the next scene you see him in, he's out in the desert hiding from a lady. He is.
Jezebel.
Yeah.
Lady.
Whoa, wow. I'm a nice guy. My mom raised me that way, so. So, but if I ever call any of you ladies a lady, I'm not referencing Jezebel, okay? But what he's not only is he hiding from the lady after this great victory, but he's also crying and whining, is he not? What's he saying? I'm the only one left. You know, it's almost like, God, why am I here? I'm the only one left. I have no use in life, you know. And we don't usually see the great prophets as whiners like that. What is interesting to me, if you've ever studied church history, and of course the people of church history are not in the Bible, they're post-biblical, but many of the great men that have built strong theologies, whether we agree with them completely or not, from Luther to Calvin to Zwingli to many of these great men, although God used them in a great way in the development of his church and stuff, they had these same personal things. They had these same struggles of faith, crisis of faith, and it's amazing how God is so much more wonderful than we are. And it's a good thing, right? You know, he doesn't rely upon us. Sometimes we think he can't do it without us, but he doesn't rely upon us. It's you and I that rely upon him. And our life would be a lot easier if we learned that quickly. And learn to not only rely upon him, but to trust him as he takes us through whatever we're going to go through.
No, they went over 100 miles one way and
yeah.
back.
Mm-hmm.
How many wells is in that area? In other words, Tucker didn't give them no, Bunnell didn't give them no water or food. You can't go 200 miles out in the desert without a supply of water.
Well, if that map is right, you have the two cities, one on one side of this river right here, one on the other side of the river, and if that community is right, they probably stayed right along that river. They were not dumb people, okay? Matter of fact, again, we went to Israel. What did they say? Every time you found a city, what would you always find?
Water.
You would find a source of water. Plus, you would find the ability to... What's the word?
Tap
Protection, yeah. It would be able to set up. A tell simply means a mountain. Okay? So you have Tel Dan. Or you have Tel Aviv. One you're very familiar with, same thing. And a tell was, you know, what on Megiddo, where you have Solomon's stables and stuff, but you have 21 layers of different cities that have been there, built up on top of each other. Yeah. All right, so he takes them through. He taught the men of Succoth. And well, said then he tore down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of that of the city. So he, interesting.
Yeah,
it's more than interesting. You know, he didn't kill the. He didn't kill the men of Succoth. He humiliated them. He disciplined them in this brutal way. But Peniel, and you have to wonder that after he went to Succoth, did he get sort of filled with, I don't know how to say it, with the bloodlust? Got carried away. Anybody ever got carried away in your anger? Anybody?
Yeah.
Where by the time you were done with whatever you were done with, you don't know how you got there, and you don't know why you did what you did. I don't think we can take that out of the equation here. You know, you see it over and over again in history. Go ahead, Kathy.
Well, we're talking about what he did to these people, but if you go a little further and see David, when I think his name is Nabal, didn't feed David and his men, David was going to kill them also.
Yeah.
So that must have been a pretty big deal to not offer hospitality or food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was no McDonald's.
Yeah, that's true. By the way, there is an old tradition of the Bedouins that are in that area, which, again, are boy, y'all got to help me with these things. I don't know where that word's not in my head. Nomadic people. They have in their tradition that they will keep someone in their house 3 days and three nights. But after that 3 days and three nights, you better be gone. I'm serious. That's how serious they are. That they open that and stuff. And you better not steal. You better not take their water. You better not take anything that hasn't been offered to you. But they'll treat you like royalty for 3 days and three nights, and then after that. So. All right. So he kills the men of Penuel. He tears down. I think he tore down the wall of the city. He made the city a non-city. He made it worthless. And he completely destroyed their identity. And if you think this is a small thing, all you got to do is read the book of Ezekiel and read the post exilic books in the Old Testament of the response of the Israelites after they were taken into captivity by Babylon, and finally found out Jerusalem was destroyed, and their response to that, and then their response when they finally got to go back to Jerusalem and all they saw was ruins. It's a huge thing. It's a huge thing. No wall, no city, no identity. These people were most of these cities actually were named after the head of a clan, the head of a family. That's who they were named after and stuff. It was their identity. It's who they were. Okay. So, verse 18. And he said to Zebah and Zumanah, these guys are about done, so I'm glad because I have to quit saying their name. It says, what kind of men were they whom you killed at Tabor? Again, Tabor is here. When did they kill the men at Tabor? I'm going to tell you, I don't know. And this is a reference to something that I don't think we have a record for. Okay, and here's what I want you to see as we read this. He said, what were these men like? And so they answer, as you are. These guys are too brutally honest. I mean, I'm going to tell you from my perspective what I'd say. I just don't happen to remember what they were like. But what do they say? They look like you, buddy. They look like you. So, each one resembled the son of a king.
That's a dig,
yes. They were ridiculing. These are kings. They're proud people, and they're spitting at Gideon here.
Why?
Gideon doesn't look like a king. Gideon is not a king. He is a young man who was found threshing wheat, hiding from these kings. He's in fear. Now, I think we have I'm going to say, as I read this, I think we have a reason for his fear right here. And here's what they said. And he said, then he said, that's Gideon said to them, these were my brothers, sons of my mother, as the Lord lives, if you had let them live, I would not kill you. So, I think we have an answer now to why Gideon was hiding from the Midianite army. His brothers were killed by him.
At Tabor.
When, we don't know. It's not this occurrence did not happen in any of the chapters we've read about Gideon. Remember, we find Gideon hiding. That's how it all begins. Now I think we have the answer as to why Gideon was hiding from the Midianite army. And God has brought it full circle. And Gideon says to him, you know, if you'd let him live, I'd let you live. So then he goes on, and he said to Jether, his firstborn, he says to his firstborn son, okay, rise, kill them. But the youth would not draw his sword, for he was afraid, because he was still a youth. Now, you take blood vengeance on someone who kills your family. That was a normal thing at that time. Gideon, I don't know why Gideon had his firstborn do this or tell his firstborn, unless he wanted to say, it's time to be a man, do what you're supposed to do. I don't know. Go ahead.
Well, my notes suggest, who knows, but this commentary writer says, for a king to be killed by a boy was a great humiliation.
A great humiliation.
Because it would look like he was no match for a boy.
Right.
So it was an added insult to have a boy killed.
Right. And it could be in response to the insult that they just made to Gideon, where he says, you know, ridiculed him, that call him look like a king when he, you know what I'm saying. So verse 21, you have these two kings. They begin. I mean, you're having this thing going back and forth. And it says, rise yourself and kill us, for as a man is, so is his strength. In other words, man, if you're a real man, Gideon, you'll do it. You're not going to send no boy to kill us. We're kings. Bravado to the end, right?
That's right. They're kings and they're going down.
So what's Gideon do? He rises and he kills them. And he takes the crescent ornaments from their camels' necks. In other words, he takes the ornaments that designate them as the kings. You know, they did it on camels. Egypt did it, and the pharaohs did it on chariots. It was something that designated that which they rode, you know, and you'll have other people do it on their horses. You can tell who the leader's horse is just by the way. So he took this as a symbol of I have defeated these kings. And we're going to have to stop there because we're over time.
That's just getting good.
That's just getting good.
Yeah.